Hello, and welcome to the Small Business University Audio Presentation of the Month. This monthly CD and web series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of teaching small business owners how to run profitable companies. Each month, a different national speaker or business owner shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. Whether the economy is up, down, or falling influences your success to a degree. What matters even more is something within your direct control, your economy, the economy of one. In this stirring presentation, internationally renowned speaker Mark Sanborn shares mindsets and methods that will keep you winning, growing, and succeeding no matter what's going on in your world. This is part one of a two-part series. Mark is an international best-selling author and noted authority on leadership and customer service. He has served as the president of the National Speakers Association and is one of the youngest speakers ever to be inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame. Mark has authored 8 books and nearly 24 audio and video training programs. Now, sit back and prepare to take some notes on how to be successful no matter what the economy may be doing.
By a show of hands, how many of you are here? It's a good question to ask. Just a few months ago, I was in St. Louis speaking to the St. Louis chapter of the National Speakers Association. And one of my colleagues, a speaker named Scott Ginsburg, raised his hand during the question and answer session and said, "Mark, what are the 3 or 4 things you do every day to ensure your ongoing success?" And I thought that was a great question, because what Scott asked me to do was to boil it down to the irreducible, to the things that I needed to do every day, the daily disciplines, the regular routines that would not only make me successful, but help me stay successful. And that's a fascinating concept to me. I mean, is it possible to be successful always, whether the economy is up, whether it's boom times or bust, or more likely whether the economy is moving sideways as it tends to do for so much of history? And so I wrote this book focusing on what shouldn't change in times of rapid change. And I started thinking about the economy. I mean, how's the economy right now? And by that, I don't mean the global economy. I don't mean the U.S. economy. What we're worried about is the economy of one, the economy of you, the economy of me. I mean, the only thing worse than a boom economy is when the economy is doing great and we're doing bad. I mean, the only thing worse than doing badly is when the economy is doing badly, making it hard for us to get better. I want to talk about what you can do to succeed, not because of, but in spite of the economy. Now, my formal education is in economics. I've studied economics. I have a degree in economics. And I can tell you this. When times are good, it's relatively easy to succeed. Have you ever heard of that saying, "In a tornado, even turkeys can fly"? Well, up until about 2008, we had had the longest protracted period of growth in the United States history. And people were doing well. But around 2008, things began to change. And it separated the men from the boys, the women from the girls, the brave from the fearful. And it's at this point that the story gets really personal. December of 2008, I was lying in bed recovering from cancer surgery. I had 8 days to think about life. I was watching TV and reading books, and of course the news was the economic meltdown, not just here in the United States, but globally. My business was off significantly. My investments had taken a huge hit, and it was too soon to tell whether or not they'd got the cancer in time and whether it had been contained. I'd experienced health challenges in the past. I'd experienced business challenges in the past, and I'd had times when my investments were down. But this was the first time I experienced all three simultaneously. I mean, it was the trifecta of challenge for me personally. And here's the odd thing. I felt oddly optimistic. I felt like even though things were tough, and even though I was unsure of the future, that I really was in pretty good shape. And the reason I felt that way is because I realized that I had been doing some things my entire adult life, some consciously and some unconsciously, that had prepared me for that time. And as a result of that, I started on this book, Up, Down, or Sideways. And today, I want to focus on this question of how you can perpetually succeed. Not just when times are good, that's relatively easy, but when times are sideways or when they're down. And what we're going to talk about in the time that we have today are basically three mindsets, three ways to think, and six methods. Now, in the time we have today, we're going to cover a lot of ground, but I have great faith that as an audience that's committed to ongoing personal and professional development, you'll be able to assimilate and learn these ideas quickly. But the question, of course, goes back to why aren't we doing more often the things that we need to be doing? If someone were to ask you, like Scott Ginsburg asked me, what are the three or four things you do every day to ensure your ongoing success? Would you be able to answer? Do you know what those three or four things are? Do you do them consistently and without fail? When I wrote the book, I realized there would be some people who would be critical of me suggesting what they should do. You know, we often resent it when people tell us what we should be or do, and we find it controlling or manipulative. But it dawned on me, all success in life is based on what I call the good shoulds. I mean, think about it. When you were a kid, didn't your mom tell you there were things you should do that benefited you greatly? I mean, your mom said, brush your teeth. Look both ways before you cross the street. Be nice to other people. Those are good shoulds. And your mom, your dad, and even me today weren't about manipulation. They were about giving you the ideas and the information that you needed to succeed. So we're going to look at some good shoulds, things that have been tested by time and proven across many different lives in many different countries and many different professions. But before we talk about the three mindsets and the six methods, what keeps us from doing what we should be doing? What are the barriers? I'm going to give you today seven levels of doing what needs to be done so that you can not only self-diagnose for yourself, but maybe even for the people you live and work with, where they're at on that scale from being unaware of what they should do to doing it consistently. So let's look at the lowest level. The lowest level is ignorance. You don't know what you should be doing. Today at the hotel, as I was walking down the hall, I noticed a woman who was slouching. She had bad posture. And I remember thinking how much better she'd feel if she just paid attention to her posture. Now, what made me aware of posture? I heard a speaker recently who talked about how posture affects not only appearance, but energy. The speaker that I was listening to was speaking about nutrition, which was of interest to me. But I picked up another insight on posture that, frankly, I hadn't thought about or considered before. So at the lowest level, we don't know what we need to know. That's ignorance. At level number two, we know it, but we don't believe it. Have you got some areas like that in your life? I mean, you know it at an intellectual level. Yeah, it's a good idea. That's probably true, but you don't believe it at a heart level. Those are the things that sound good, but they sound a lot better for somebody else. At level two, you intellectually know, but you aren't really convinced at a heart level. At level three, you know it, and you believe it, but you can't do it. And that's the level where you're basically lacking skills or abilities. In other words, you'd like to do it, but no one's ever shown you how. I wonder when it comes to financial literacy, how many people just lack the basic skills? They'd like to be more responsible. They'd like to be in better control of their financial destiny, but they never learned the skills that they needed. And it's at that level, level three, that you need to read a book or go to a seminar, or take a course, or maybe go back to college. Because if you know it and you believe it, you know that it'll benefit you, you need to know how to do it. And that's level three. You know it, you believe it, but you don't know how to do it. At level four, you know it, you believe it, you know how to do it, but you still don't do it. Let me give you the best illustration of that. Kids. I say to my son, Hunter, Hunter, this is the third time I told you to put the dishes away. And Hunter says, yeah, Dad, I know. And I say, then do it. What is it at this level, at level four, that keeps us from doing what we know and believe we should be doing? It's a pretty complex answer, actually. It's very exotic, strange, and unusual. It's called laziness. It's called lethargy. We just don't want to be inconvenienced. We don't want to invest the time or the energy to do it. And as a result, we won't benefit until we get to level 5. Level 5 is when we know it and we believe it and we do it inconsistently. Many of you in the room right now do lots of good things, but you do them inconsistently. I know people that exercise every 3 or 4 months. And they don't really seem surprised when at the end of an exercise session they aren't healthier and buffer and haven't lost weight, because they realize that inconsistent effort gives you inconsistent benefits. Inconsistent effort gives you inconsistent results. That's why the sixth level is key. And that's where you know it and you do it consistently. You choose to do it. You make room in your life for it. You schedule it. You become fanatical about making sure that it gets done. And the beauty of level 6 is that when you consistently do something, you consistently benefit from it. But there's a 7th and even higher level. And that's the level where you do something so consistently that it becomes second nature. You don't have to think about it anymore. As a matter of fact, you'd have to think about it to not do it. You would have to consciously choose to quit doing it because you naturally do it on a regular, consistent basis. Recently, I heard John Maxwell speak to the John Maxwell Company, of which he is the founder. And to date, he's written something like 60 books. And John said, you know, I'm often asked, how do you write 60 books? He said, the answer is simple. Every day I read, every day I take notes, every day I ask questions, every day I file ideas. He paused and then he said, every day? Every day. On vacation? Every day, even on vacation. Well, but what about Christmas and holidays? On Christmas and holidays, I read, I take notes, I ask questions, I file ideas. I've got to believe that John has made his system second nature. And that's why he does it, even on vacation, even on holidays. And the things that we're going to talk about today will really benefit you the most, and importantly, the people that you care for and love, when you make them second nature. Now, I mentioned there's a total of 9, 3 mindsets and 6 methods. But I think what you're going to see as we go along today is how they all fit together and how they all interrelate, impact, and leverage each other. But let's begin by looking at the 3 mindsets. Here's the 3 mindsets, and then we'll discuss each of them individually. Mindset number 1 is the scorekeeper's secret. The scorekeeper's secret says how you keep score determines how you play the game. The second mindset is the optimist's orientation. You may have heard it said that attitude is everything. I don't believe attitude is everything, but I believe it's the first thing. And the third mindset is the learner's leverage. You and I must keep learning because the world keeps changing. The scorekeeper's secret, the optimist's orientation, and the learner's leverage. Those are the 3 mindsets that I should believe should become a regular routine and a daily discipline for all of us. So let's go back and look at the scorekeeper's secret. How you keep score determines how you play the game. Over the course of my 53 years, I've had a chance to meet a lot of interesting people. I know people that are salt of the earth, working class people. I have a number of friends who are millionaires, and I've even met a few billionaires. 2 things I've observed about all the people I've met when it comes to success. The first is this: success is specific to the individual. Be concerned of anyone that would try to define success for you personally. They can give you ideas and guidance, but ultimately, success and how we define it is a personal choice. But the second thing I've learned about success is that very few people use a singular measure for success. Of all the people I've ever met, I can count on one hand or less the number of people who have told me that money is the primary or even the most important way they measure their success. And yet that's what seems to preoccupy us the most. Now, if you're going to succeed all the time in life, and money is the only measure that you use, there are going to be times you're not successful. If you live long enough, you're going to suffer a financial setback. You're going to make a bad investment. I believe that the fewer measures we use for success, the less likely we will be successful. The fewer measures we use, when we put too much emphasis on one thing to the exclusion of others, the less likely we will be able to perpetually achieve and be successful. What I'd like you to do, not just during this program, but after the program's over, is to really think about something that the average American doesn't consider, and that is, how do I define success? I read once that in the United States, 3 out of every 4 Americans do not have a worldview. Now, a worldview is a little bit different than a definition of success. A worldview is just a clear explanation of what you believe and why you believe it. 1 out of 4 have a worldview, 3 out of 4 don't. If you don't have a worldview, it's going to be very difficult to determine what success is. As a matter of fact, for a number of years when I would speak, I would ask my audiences, just as kind of an informal poll, why they got out of bed in the morning. I would say to the audience, why do you get out of bed in the morning? I did this for almost 10 years on and off. And in 10 years, I only ever got 2 responses. The first response was, well, I have to. I've got to. Now, I don't want to be sarcastic or flip, but the reality is most of us today, we do not have to get out of bed in the morning. If we lay there long enough, somebody would come and check up on us. Yeah, your spouse would wonder why you weren't at breakfast. He or she'd come and check up on you. You say, well, Mark, I'm single. I live alone. Well, they'd miss you at work. They'd send somebody to check up on you. You say, Mark, they don't like me at work. Well, they'd send the government to check up on you. The reality is most people really don't have to get out of bed in the morning, but they feel that compulsion, that obligation. Now, the second reason people tell me they get out of bed in the morning, and I'm just being very honest with you in the Detroit metro area today, I say, why do you get out of bed in the morning? People say, because I have to go to the bathroom. Now, does this explain a lot about the people you work with? Why'd you come into the office today? Oh, I don't know, got up about 6 to go to the bathroom. As long as I was up, figured might as well come on into work. Most people are more motivated by their bladders than their beliefs. And most people don't have a scorekeeping system. They don't know what they believe or why they believe it, and therefore, they do not know what's important. As you define success, I'd like you to consider these elements in your definition. I believe that there's basically 4 ways we organize our lives. I call them the 4 R's. Again, very few people use only one of these 4 R's. But I find for most people, 1 of the 4 is primary. And what you choose to make primary in your scorekeeping system very much affects how you play the game. The first of the 4 R's are results. These are people who want to get things done. They want to have something tangible to show for their effort. They want to achieve. They tend to be very competitive. They want to rise to the top by making things happen. The second kind of person is more focused on the rewards. Now, these people tend to produce a lot of results, but they're more interested in the recognition they get, the money they get, the stuff they're able to achieve from the results they produce. In other words, for people who make rewards primary, the results are a means to an end. The third category, and think if you know anyone like this, they organize their life around recreation. It's about going to work 8 or 10 hours a day so they can enjoy the evenings and the weekends, so they can play sports or go out on the lake in their boat or ride their motorcycle. The results and the rewards may happen, but it really allows them to enjoy their leisure in the way that they desire. The fourth kind of person is the person who makes relationships primary. That person says that, as an adult, I need to be a constructive, contributing member of society. I need to provide for my family through the results and the rewards. And I certainly enjoy recreation, but it all means very little without relationship. Now, I'm oversimplifying because we have limited time today, but I'm going to paint with a big brushstroke and just share that it's my observation that those people who make relationships primary tend to achieve in the other 3 areas as well. Everything that we are able to accomplish in the way of results, we accomplish with the cooperation and support of others. Rewards and recognition would not come if there weren't others who cared enough about us to notice what we're doing. And of course, the loneliest person is the person who has a big boat and nobody to share it with. I'm not suggesting today how you organize your life or what your value system should be. What I am suggesting is that you ask yourself, how am I defining success? Because the measure that you use will determine how you play the game of your life. Now, this is a really important concept. Perpetual achievement, the ability to be successful always, is built on this one scorekeeping idea. If you regularly do things that you know will benefit you and those you love, by the very act of doing those things that may not benefit you until later, you are achieving. In other words, it's not about winning or losing. Can you win all the time? No. I don't believe anyone can win all the time. Can you succeed all the time? If success is doing the things that you know will eventually benefit you and the people you love, and you consistently do them, then you are succeeding all the time. And that, to me, is the essence of perpetual achievement. The first mindset, the scorekeeper's secret. The second mindset, the optimist's orientation. This was the easiest chapter for me to write in the book because I'm the worst at it. I don't know if it's genetics, I don't know if it's environment, but I was born with a negative predisposition. And because of that liability in my life, I've had to study and work very hard to overcome it. The optimist orientation says how you look at the world isn't based on the world around you, but it actually shapes the world around you. How you look at the world isn't just an interpretation of the world around you, it actually shapes the world around you. Maybe you know somebody like my friend Don Hudson. He says he is a reverse paranoid. You know what a reverse paranoid is? That's a person that believes everybody's out to help them. Most of us are paranoid. We think people are out to get us. Don assumes the best about people. He thinks people are out to help. I'm going to recommend a book called The Happiness Advantage. Sean Aker in The Happiness Advantage shares a very wide overview of the scientific research that is validating what we've always intuitively believed to be true. Maybe you know somebody that's criticized your focus on the positive and the upbeat, and they've said it was delusional or wishful thinking. What Sean Aker talks about in his book is recent research that validates that how we view the world affects how we achieve in the world. And I'm going to summarize the entire book in this idea. We are not positive and happy because we are successful. We are successful because we are positive and happy. And for years, people have got it out of order. People have said, well, yeah, you know, if I had his money, I'd be positive too. If I had her success, I'd have a better attitude. And what Aker has found in reviewing the research, and by the way, he studied neuroscience and happiness for over a decade at Harvard and helped design one of the first courses in positive psychology. So this is a guy who knows whereof he speaks. His findings are based on a relatively new development in neuroscience called the mirror neuron. Mirror neurons allow us to imprint ideas and attitudes through simply observing the world around us. By a show of hands, how many of you know who Mary Mallon was? Mary Mallon was a big deal. She was world famous. Most people didn't know her last name. They knew her by her nickname, Typhoid Mary. Typhoid Mary was the first known healthy carrier of typhoid. She was born in Ireland and moved to the United States, where she became a cook and later domestic help. She infected 53 people with typhoid, even though she herself did not have it. Three of those people died. Here's what's even more interesting. She wanted to care for the people who had typhoid, so by continuing to care for them, she infected others despite her best intentions. And one of the things that the world learned from Typhoid Mary, we have now learned from neuroscience, and that is that we're all contagious. Doesn't matter if we know it or not. People are watching and imprinting our attitudes, our emotions, and our predispositions, even if they don't consciously like or agree with it. And that's why some workplaces are so toxic. A toxic boss is a man or a woman who's just, their very demeanor makes everyone unhappy and negative. It's not what they do to people as much as it's what they do in front of people. And by choosing our attitude rather than letting it be chosen by default, by getting actively involved in how we imprint in our mind, we can become more positive and more upbeat. By the way, one of the things I've learned from Mary Mallon, Typhoid Mary, it's possible to be sincere and still be dangerous. In a world where everyone seems to want to give us advice, and we're going to talk about this in the Learner's Leverage, it's very important that we understand that sincerity is no guarantee of success. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Let me give you 5 steps that you can use to harness the optimist orientation so that you can become more positive and upbeat without anything changing. You can be positive and upbeat, up, down, or in between. And here's the first step. Know the difference between skepticism and cynicism. The skeptic says, show me. The cynic says, don't bother, I've already decided. The skeptic is a seeker. The skeptic is open to new information. They're not ready to agree right away, but they're willing to consider it. Whereas the cynic, which comes from the Latin word that means like the dog, has already decided that positive thinking and success seminars and the rest are all bunk. Once you become a cynic, you close off any opportunity to improve your attitude. The second key is to choose reality over fantasy. I think it's very important that we understand that positive people do not deny reality. You've got to know what's happening. When I say choose reality over fantasy, what I'm saying is don't deny the bad, but focus primarily on the good. See, that's the key. You're not denying that bad things happen, that there's poverty, that there's homelessness, that there's inner city problems, because if you deny that, how could you ever help? You don't need to deny reality. You've got to choose reality over fantasy. You must be both informed and inspired. Number 3, try a different perspective. Look at it differently. You're going to hear my friend Shep Hyken speak, some of you, and he does magic, and I've always had an interest in magic, and I read an article in Scientific American about how your perspective changes the illusion. A reader wrote in and said that he had recorded some magic shows from his TV and he'd come home from work to watch them, but he was very tired, so he began watching the magic show sitting up and was impressed by the tricks. He decided to lay down. Guess what happened? He started to spot the trick. He started to see the illusion and how it was done, and what he realized is that magic was designed for a vertical perspective, the misdirection and the tricks, but that when he was lying down horizontally, the change in perspective let him see something he would not otherwise have seen. Would you not agree with me that when you put yourself in somebody else's shoes, you change your perspective and become more empathetic? Would you not agree that if you want to be more creative, maybe you need to look at it as an amateur instead of an expert, because maybe your expertise keeps you from seeing some things that the amateur sees? See, that's why I believe that the third key is to change your perspective. Again, it's the same reality, you're just viewing it from a different angle. Number 4, look for the humor. You don't have to look very hard. I think humor is what sustains us in difficult times and makes the up times even better. As a matter of fact, I've heard it said, and maybe you have as well, that God gave us a sense of humor because he knew there'd be problems we couldn't solve and people we didn't like. But I believe you have to look for it. My wife and I were driving in downtown Denver. We saw a homeless man. Now, would you agree with me that if you're homeless, things are definitely down. You're facing some serious challenges. But this guy had not lost his sense of humor. He had a big sign. It said, "Wife captured by ninjas, need money for karate lessons." I liked this sign, but more importantly, it was proof to me that the human spirit is more resilient when it can find the humor in a situation, that we connect at a humor level, and that the optimist orientation says things might be bad, but the world still has mirth. There are still some things that can lighten my load and make the journey more pleasant. So number 4 is look for humor. Number 5, take a lesson from the Marines. Are there any Marines in the room today? I'd like to have a special blessing and thanks for the men and women of our country who have served in the military, who have given us the gift of freedom. And my friend Cleve McClary served during the Vietnam War. Cleve came back. He had made quite a sacrifice. He lost an eye. He lost an arm. He suffered severe injuries. And CLEAB taught me an acronym that the Marines use during battle and outside of battle. And the acronym is FIDO, F-I-D-O. And it stands for Forget It and Drive On. Forget it and drive on. Sometimes we don't understand why things happen. I think some people become permanently trapped in their regrets and they justify it as an attempt to understand. I'm not sure why things happen. I'm not sure why bad things happen to good people and good things happen to rotten people. I don't know. And so sometimes at the end of the day, the optimist orientation says if you can't figure it out, if you can't laugh at it, forget it, drive on. FIDO. It works for the Marines and it can work for you and I, if we want to harness this thing I call the optimist orientation. And finally, the third mindset, the learner's leverage. We must keep learning because the world keeps changing. In 1902, Rodin created one of the most famous sculptures in history. It was called the Poet. You're not familiar with the Poet because it's more commonly known as the Thinker. There are a number of copies of this sculpture scattered throughout the world, but I've been fortunate enough to visit Italy in the museum where the primary sculpture exists. And most people look at the Thinker and never give it a second thought. The Thinker was Rodin's attempt to portray what Dante must have looked like as he was working through a particularly difficult passage in the Divine Comedy. But what I want you to think about today is the message of the sculpture, because if you haven't looked at it closely, you missed the point that Rodin was trying to make. The Thinker's right elbow is on his left knee. Try it. It's very uncomfortable. It's very difficult. It's unnatural to put your hand under your chin and put your right elbow on your left knee. And what Rodin was trying to communicate is that thinking is hard, but it's important. So many people live on autopilot. They don't give it a second, much less a third thought. They assimilate ideas without knowing why, and they stop learning as soon as they graduate from high school or from college. One of my old friends and a founder of the National Speakers Association, Cabot Robert, used to say, "School is never out for the professional." If you want to be able to succeed, regardless of circumstance, you've got to keep learning. And in the old days, the way that we learned was we would access information and then apply it. You would go to the source of that information, whether it was a library or a teacher, a counselor, a pastor, a professor. You would go to the source, you would access the information he or she had, and then if you were a good learner, you would apply it in your life. By the way, I got to tell you something today. It's kind of a secret most people don't know. You're not learning right now. And I hope it's not just because of me. Frankly, you're not learning whenever you listen to a speaker or a pastor or a teacher. As my friend Scott Halford says, you're gathering. You're gathering ideas. You're writing them down. You're etching them in your brain. You learn them when you leave and apply them. Learning happens in the application. And it's as simple as understanding how you learn to ride a bike. You didn't read a book until you mastered what the book said about the bike. You learn to ride a bike by getting on the bike and falling off and getting back on. What happens most of the time is gathering. The hard work of learning is when we apply the information. So in the past, you accessed and applied. Today, there's a new skill set. And this isn't going to change in the future. There's a middle step. You must access, then assess, and then apply. The key to the new world of learning is assessing the validity of the information. A lot of bad information out there. I love the internet. I'm an internet junkie, and yet I am fully aware that so much of what exists in cyberspace is not based in reality. It simply isn't true. When I was diagnosed with cancer, I had a booklet sent to me from a very well-meaning human being who, like Mary Mallon, was sincere. She wanted to help. And the book was about a rare metal that, if ingested, could cure cancer. There was no data in the book. There were just three long stories about people who took this rare metal and got better. And I was reminded that anecdote is not the plural of data. Anecdotes are simply stories that may or may not be true. And lacking research, I decided to pass on that particular treatment for my cancer. Remember how I said it's possible to be well-intentioned and still be wrong? It's possible to be sincere and to be incorrect? I believe the most important skill that you and I need for the future is the ability to assess information for its validity. And here's how you assess it. First, you look at the source. Does he or she have credibility? Have they done the hard work and the research to truly understand the advice that they are giving? Beware of taking financial advice from people who are financially destitute. Beware of taking health advice from people who aren't healthy. We know this at an obvious level, but how often do we take advice and discount the source that we get it from? The next key is the evidence that the advice is valid, the research, the data. The third consideration is relevance. There's a lot of information that is true, it's just not relevant to me. If you've never had cancer, then all the cancer treatments that people talk about on the internet and in doctors and hospitals offices doesn't really matter. For information to be assessed, it needs to be relevant to your challenge, your situation. And finally, the last thing you need to look at is the fit. And what I mean by fit is simply this. There are a lot of things in life we can do that we may just choose not to do. Doesn't feel right. It's true, it's credible, but it just isn't consistent or congruent with who we are. And the learner's leverage is about accessing, finding the information you need, then assessing its validity before you apply it. And when you apply it, not only does learning take place, but you enjoy the benefits. Some ideas I suggest for you to develop the learner's leverage. The first idea is this: make time to learn. Don't leave it to chance. I typically do my learning in the morning before my kids wake up or before I go to the office, because once the phone starts to ring and the family's up and about, it's very difficult for me to read and to reflect and to truly gather and learn. The second key I'd suggest is that you develop a learning agenda. That you don't make it haphazard, but that you zero in on what do I need to know or what do I want to know more about. Make time to learn, and then have an agenda. But the third key is to learn in future tense. Learn in future tense. Learn before you need to learn. Don't wait until your boss says you could get promoted, but you'll need to have a degree first, and that might take a year or 2 years before you can do it. Learning in future tense simply says think about what you need to know before you need to know it and learn it in advance. And that's part of the learner's leverage. Now let's see if we can tie those three things together. A World War II veteran named Augustine, his friends called him Aug, came back from the military and tried to sell life insurance. He was married, had two young daughters, and didn't do very well in his chosen profession. While he'd served his country admirably, flying over 30 missions in the war, he didn't do nearly as well in the workplace. And at the end of a long day, he decided that he needed to treat himself with a drink. After all, it was tough. Before he knew it, what became the occasional drink became the perpetual drink and became alcoholism. He lost his wife and his two daughters. They left him, and he became a vagrant who basically traveled around the United States picking up odd jobs. And his life kept slinking lower and lower and lower into the pit. And it was in Cleveland, destitute, certainly down and nearly out, that he stopped to look in a window of a pawn shop at a $29 revolver. He had scraped together just enough money to buy the gun that could conceivably end his life. And he had to make a decision at that point. And I know it sounds cliche, but it's true. He could either let his bitterness end his life, or he could determine to get better. And rather than get bitter, he kept walking until he came to a public library. He liked writing. That's what he had done as a youth. And even though he'd been unsuccessful as a writer to date, he went into the warmth of the library, got out of the weather, and he started to read the great self-help books, the classics. And slowly, he started to apply the ideas that he gathered and learned. And he later went on to become the editor of Success Magazine and one of the best-selling authors in history of self-help books. His name was Aug Mandino. Aug Mandino harnessed all three of the things that we just talked about. He changed his scoring system. It became about what he learned and taught, not about what he had and did. He became optimistic because he learned through the pages of the great books that Optimism was a choice, that there were things you could do even when your life was in terrible straits that would improve it. And his perpetual learning is, of course, what made him one of the great self-help writers of all time. In the 70 minutes or so that we talk about perpetual achievement, how to succeed when times are good, bad, or in between, if you were to think of one thing, if you were to think back in the weeks and months and years ahead to one idea, it's this. Hope is having something new to try and being willing to try it. There is no hopeless situation if you've got something new to try and you're willing to try it. There's no failed relationship if you've got something new you're willing to try in the relationship. There's no destitute financial situation if you've got a new idea you can try to generate revenue and to get yourself out of that situation. I find that when times are up, people don't think about it, but when times are down and they most need hope, they forget that hope isn't some kind of magical elixir. It's simply learning and having the kind of attitude and the kind of scorekeeping system that will give you something new to try and then to be willing to try it. The optimist orientation, the scorekeeper secret, and the learner's leverage. Those are the three mindsets that enable perpetual achievement.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Please feel free to give us a call at 877-202-8891. The vision of Grandy & Associates is quite simple. We teach companies how to run profitable businesses. For more information on how we do that, check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or give us a call at 1-877-202-8891. The Small Business University audio series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-877-202-8891. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.